Well, welcome back. We are going to start the afternoon proceedings with a poem and some poetry. And I am particularly excited to introduce our next guest because I personally love her work. And I especially requested that I do her introduction. Yeah, I did. That's what you get to do when you help organize something. She is a writer, a performer, an educator, and an activist. She's a woman after my own heart. She holds 4 national titles in the 3 years that she's been competing in SLAM. She is presently the only person to have held 2 national titles at one time, and the only person in history, only poet in history, to win the Women of the World Poetry Championship twice. She's also an athlete. And I mean a serious one. She is a former 1996 Olympic volleyball player. Yeah. She has over 10 years' experience as a licensed teacher. She holds a double master's degree in education and English. It is my absolute honor to invite Dominique Christina to the stage. Big hands.
How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Okay, they were worried about people not being able to hear me. It would be the first time if that happens. It would be the first time for me. So, for me, it's always appropriate to, before I speak, to bring my grandmother into the room. Because she was big like that. And she transitioned when I was 1 month away from delivering my firstborn. It's a strange birth-death ritual that always seems to happen in my family. So this first poem is for me to just be grounded in this space with you and for you to get a sense of who I am and from whence I sprang. This is from my grandmother. This is called Colossal. My grandmother, willful girl of Danville, Arkansas, a town dizzy in obscurity and poultry farms, a town that stretched for 5 thin miles of water bugs, ticks, and snakes. She was ashy knees and knuckles, white bobby socks, starched white, dust-bitten black shoes, always a ruffled hem. She kept a wilderness in her bones. To be a woman is to resist, is to avoid capture. This is what my grandmother gave me, brain and legs, defiant heart, an interrupted girlishness. The woman I remember was a spear, frightening and resolute, a siren, a wound clock, a barbed wire blue note woman composed of broomsticks, bricks, and the kind of longing that keeps a fist in a homemade apron. This is what my grandmother gave me. How to be iron. The anonymous groaning of long ago women who sizzled up through the ages and gave us belonging, and mostly, my grandmother is permanent. This is tactical if you are a woman and you wish to remain alive. My grandmother, the untransformed Cinderella, the tempest, damnably, impossibly alive. This is what my grandmother gave me, the fight. The immorality of a white flag flown, the necessary scrap and gristle, the way to Medusa the flesh, to dance the sugared bones until limbs are savagely young, completely free, the blood longing of summer, the click and purr of us, the serpentine witch, nocturne hunter, the radical translation of a would-be ruined woman, fanatical hissing sister, mythologized as monster, the quintessential feminist, agonizingly familiar. This is what my grandmother gave me. The open mouth. Yeah. The mermaid ritual. The surprise ending. The central conflict of the protagonist is how much to love. and how much to fight, how much bone to surrender to plot, the splendid rhythm of it, the unvanished soul, the bitch, the mother, the vixen, the wolf glowing red with want. See, these are the fullness of my personhood, and this is what my grandmother gave me. There is no ending to this poem. I do not come from women who know how to leave a story finished. This is going to go on and on and on. And isn't that the melody? Isn't that the way we, amen, the glittered chorus of our right now personhood leaving a trail of breadcrumbs for the next willful girl to follow? Isn't that the circumnavigation of it, to hold each dramatic part, to go unkilled, unburied, unrehearsed, to let the music of our impromptu lives give us the way to Jezebel the dance, to be big on purpose, blood tested, filled with zeal, sizzling with enthusiasm, leaping, unconquered, free. See, in the beginning of the word, there was only one word, and it was woman. Listen. So I'm aware that there was a panel, an ecological panel that preceded me, and I'm aware that after me there will be a panel about resistance communities, and I'm poised between them, which is kind of delicious. So I want to read two more pieces, and this next one probably speaks to the panel that came before me. And then my last piece hopefully will introduce an appropriate climate for what is to come when I leave. This poem is called Gaia. I think it's really interesting how there are so many terms that we've had to come up with just to sort of describe and find language around being connected, you know, being in balance and being in integrity with the earth. That looks like activism now, because that's how dysfunctional we are. Right? So this poem is How to Meet the Mother. Walking into a field, flowering and full of itself, the earthworm circus tunneling under your feet in their dark, hidden wet, the universe practicing her blue note dance, the grand mud rehearsal. In the Dondu limbo of early morning hush and tiptoe, slip slide, mossy green secrets, and the fickle veil of a transcendent sun hanging deliciously like a quartered orange pineapple in the eternal limbs of a wind fresh blue whipped sky. This is the mother. You do not need a formal introduction to dance inside her body. Who taught you to forget her name? She is the once and future holding place, the creation story, the biggest pronoun, the widest door, the deepest love. My grandfather showed me how to genuflect in a garden. We wore dirty knuckles and wide smiles, the uniform of faithful parishioners, tomato plant and collard green worship, the amen plaza of beets and chard, the coral rumpus of vine and root, the kind that sounds like hawthorn trees bending to meet an inevitable wind. Flowers shimmying, nectar delicious, they lift their skirts and wait for a sting. They know what their own music is. They do not ask for permission to dance out loud, to take the sun into their mouths, to leap when they open, to curtsy when they close. What a necessary rhythm. The scripture of thicket and rock. Gaia, yours is a seedling epistle of yes. A place where the wilderness gets to keep her songs, the dirt-born symphony we are born, swinging our feet to Gaia. Coy mistress of morning, sweet air soliloquy in a right now heaven, how did you get so big? the super terrestrial, otherworldly algorithm of plants and people. We can never be born enough, Gaia. You show us how to stretch our own skin to grow with intent, to lean into our galloping want, to recognize the nectar inside, to use the raw material of possible. Gaia, the mother. And somehow, the mother is always at risk. But we know how to live more than one life, how to aim for the air in our lungs and distill every honeyed cell to starshine. We know how to do this. We know how to pull the wind over our shoulders, how to ride the night sky like children who have not forgotten their magic. And for my own Colosseum heart, let me grow up to be a yellow dahlia, to dance the brush fire in my body, to celebrate the wildlife left in these bones. Nothing, nothing that grows purposefully questions the sun about her offering or the petals that open and close. Let me grow like that. Let us grow like that. Let the music of our own becoming be familiar. Let us walk right up to the thing that can heal us. Stretch out our hand and say, oh, friend, it's been a long time. So for this last piece, what preamble do I offer here? You know, there was a time, by virtue of my conditioning, whereby I would have apologized for this poem and been trying to take care of you through it, you know, like make sure you know that you're safe and I'm not going to hurt you. I'm past that now. This poem, quite simply, for me, didn't feel like a poem at all when it exited my body. I was angry and uproarious and feeling quite riotously. And you know, the thing about being a writer is that you always reach this crisis where you're like, this is not enough. These are just poems, you know. So I was very much in that space. I had a steady diet of CNN. That'll do it to you. So this poem is called Karma, and it is in every way the weight that I carry, historically and contemporarily. It's about the bodies that we're supposed to, that are supposed to remain nameless. And it's about my attempt to try to integrate them all into my consciousness, grieve them all. And in some cases, I even feel like I should avenge them all. So this is karma. We become poets in an attempt to tether words to righteousness, our notebooks to social consciousness. Sitting cross-legged and anxious in wingback chairs, we sip lattes to news of regimes, firing American-made artillery into crowds of folk, their bodies pickled by the sun. They line streets in countries we never think about. And we suck our teeth and ask a thesaurus to become a machete. And as romantic as pacifism is, these days I dream of dictators falling headfirst into karma and forget to be afraid. If I could write this shit in fire, I would write this shit in fire. This ain't poetry. It's rage unmuted, a verb, a means, an end. This is my body. It's a sacrifice, an offering. This is Sankofa, Amandla. This is Southside Chicago, Compton, California, Red Hook Projects in Jersey, Roosevelt Projects in Brooklyn. This is severed hands, clubs against flesh, black boots to pregnant bellies, sterilizations, inoculations, leg irons, chains, the bit, the noose. This is a war cry. You can tell Massa I'm coming back. Carrying fire in my knapsack, tell him I'm Patrice Lumumba, Stephen Biko, Fred Hampton, Fannie Lou Hamer, Harriet Tubman, tell him they have been born again in me. Tell him I found my mother tongue buried under the rubble of the World Trade Center. Tell him this shit ain't no poem. This is me running naked from sugarcane and cotton fields, having dropped my crocus sack. Tell him. He can call me karma. I'm refleshing the bones, a witch, a root worker, a sorceress, a priestess. Tell him this is the result of segregation. Tell him this is the result of integration. Tell him I have never been invisible. Tell him he has never been invincible. Tell him I'm going to melt the barbed wire and steel bars of prison yards. They're going to flow over him like lava. I am returned. I am bloodthirsty. I am fangs and hooks, swollen feet in welfare lines, the gauntlet thrown down, lines drawn in the sand. I'm apocryphal. Historical deletions gathering themselves up and back into textbooks. I am the niece of exploitation on a rice and pancake box, you know, come to collect the royalties for Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben. I'm a line of smoke, a rain dance. The tomahawk used to kill the first invader. The streets of Benghazi popped in prayer beads and shell casings, the juxtaposition of faith and savagery. You can tell him. I'm African wide hips and American bulimia. Peace symbols affixed onto assault rifles. It is the deepest kind of contradiction. If I could write this shit in fire, I would write this shit in fire. You tell Massa I'm coming back. Howl in the wind, coming back. Burr in his heel, coming back. Oh, I'm coming back, Massa. I'm coming back, Massa. I'm coming back. Thank you.
Is this on? Wow, I said. I'll say it again. I don't know what I'm going to say after that. Next panel is going to be on building resistance communities, and the moderator is going to be Dar Jamail, who will introduce the speakers. So is Dar over here? Here he is.
Thanks. Come on out, everyone. I guess, first of all, could we hear that last poem again? That was amazing. Well, thanks everyone for being here, and I want to thank the organizers for giving me the honor to chair this panel. It's really an honor to sit up here with these folks, and for those who aren't already aware of the kind of work these folks are doing, you're about to be made very aware. This is a panel on building resistance communities. What does it take to build oppositional communities capable of achieving their goals? What are the role and structure of leadership in this process? So I will start with doing a brief introduction of each panelist, and then everyone will be given about 10 minutes uninterrupted to share, and then we'll follow that with a discussion. I will start going in order of how folks have seated themselves. Sabah Malik is a political activist who has organized on issues of racism, peak oil, and anti-civilization resistance for many years. The course of her life changed during the 1990s when she visited the remote communities of the Hunza Valley in Pakistan and lived with land-based peoples engaged in sustainable living practices. She is a board member of the Fertile Ground Environmental Institute and is passionately committed to organized political resistance. Mm-hmm. Sitting beside her is Togustai. Togustai received much of his cultural training from his late grandparents. Their teachings brought him through much of the ancient and unceded landscapes. Togustai takes the responsibilities of being a hereditary chief very seriously. His philosophy is based on the ancient Wet'suwet'en philosophy called Wigus, which requires the highest level of understanding, respect, and humility for absolutely everything. There is no price that will ever compromise his responsibility of ensuring that there is always something for his for the unborn generations. Next is Sakej Ward, who belongs to the Wolf Clan. Sakej is a veteran of both the Canadian and American militaries. He graduated from the University of New Brunswick from the honors program with a bachelor's in political science with a specialization in international relations. He also attended the University of Victoria, where he successfully completed the Master's of Arts in Indigenous Governance. He has a long history of advocating and protecting First Nations' inherent responsibilities and freedoms, having spent the last 21 years fighting the government and industry. For his efforts in protecting Indigenous people, freedoms, and territory, he has received the National Aboriginal Achievement Award. Having taught, organized, advised, and led various warrior societies from all over Turtle Island, Sakej has made warriorhood his way of life. He has been on over a dozen warrior operations and countless protest actions. He dedicates all his time to developing warrior teachings and instructing warrior societies from all over. Lastly, Frida Houston was chosen to be spokesperson for the Oostetin clan in 2008. Her responsibilities as a spokesperson include holding meetings between her hereditary clan chiefs, performing liaison duties with industry and government, coordinate message for media, and research all aspects of which are brought up for discussion regarding clan business. Much of her grounding comes from being raised following the seasonal hunting and fishing on her people's lands and waterways. Both she and Togustai are representatives of the Oostetin camp, a resistance community whose purpose is to protect sovereign Wet'suwet'en territory from several proposed pipelines from the Tar Sands Giga Project and shale gas from hydraulic fracturing projects in the Peace River region. And we will start with hearing from Sabah.
Thank you. Thank you, first of all, everybody who's here, everybody who came. As an organizer, I want to particularly thank the Wallace Action Fund, without whose generous grant this event would not be possible. And I'm hoping one of our visions for this event was that it wouldn't just be another conference where people came, were inspired for a couple of days, bought a t-shirt, and went home. We are hoping that this event just starts something, starts a conversation, and translates into some real action. And for that reason, we're encouraging people to take the conversation further. We have an action hub in the lobby where if people are inspired to start new coalitions, new projects, that they can leave their information or their ideas and they can collaborate with some of the amazing grassroots activists who are here, because I know a lot of people have traveled quite far distances to come here and listen to some of these conversations. So thank you for that. I want to start with talking about what resistance means, because it can mean many things. And on one level, I think we often hear about decolonizing ourselves first, that the most important work is first to decolonize ourselves from the toxicity of the present culture. And that is the ability to not be adversely affected by something that's toxic. That's one definition of resistance. And in another definition, of resistance. It's a refusal. It's a refusal to accept or comply with something. And it doesn't just stop at refusal to accept or comply, but it's an attempt to prevent that something by action or argument. And in another sense, another definition of resistance could be, it's the inherent ability of every living organism to resist harmful influences. And so one of the things I think we need to do today is there have been some talk of what it means to be a warrior. I think we just heard from a warrior when she was on the stage telling us her words. That was amazing. And Sakaj turned to me and said, how do we follow that? Well, we're here. We're trying to follow it. We're trying to follow you, Dominique. And I think one of the things that stays with me is a quote from Mel Basil, who says, the way of the warrior is to explore all peaceful methods, and when these fail, to recognize that it's time to do battle. I think that we've reached that point. I think that, yeah. Clap. We've been there for a while. And I say this because we've had what passes for an environmental movement for around 50 years, if we chart the beginning from the publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, that's almost 50 years ago. 50 years of environmentalism in this country, and yet every single living system is in decline. In decline. It's not even stable. It's in decline. And there's not a single peer-reviewed article in the last 30 years that contradicts that statement. So I want to talk a little bit about building communities and what it means to build a community, to build a resistance community. And I'm talking from my own experience of being involved with a couple of groups. One is DGR, which I helped to build. And some of the things that we have learned along the way. And I think that what's really important is that we need hundreds and hundreds of groups working in coalition to face down power. That's what it's going to take if we're going to win. And one of the things I'd say is you have to find a central focus, because there's so much wrong. What's your passion? Is it the oceans? Is it the rivers? Is it the old growth forest? Is it social injustices? I mean, the only good thing, Derek often says this, Derek Jensen, that is, that the only good thing about everything being so screwed up is that there's plenty of work to do. Yeah. And I think we can't, you know, no one group can address everything. So pick your issue. And then don't be one person. Kathleen Dean Moore said, that was her reply in a recent interview she gave, and she was asked, what can one person do? And her answer was, don't be one person. Exactly. Find others who feel passionately about what you feel passionately about. And then create a community around it. And how is that community created? What we've learned in DGR, that it was extremely important to have structure, to have leadership roles, to have norms and rules. And I know that on the left side of politics, those kinds of words, rules and norms, are a dirty word almost. And even structure is a dirty word. And I want to say that I really disagree with that. One, because I think Stanley Diamond said something that is very true. And he said there is a difference between the rule of law as opposed to the order of custom. And one of the things I learned when I was in Hunza, which was alluded to in my... I spent some time in Hunza in the 1990s. And at that time, I didn't have the words for it, but what I was experiencing was a land-based sustainable culture. Now, they had no police. They had no written laws. But they had plenty of rules and customs, which they stuck to. And they had structure, and they had leadership, and it was all community based, and they had strict rules about how you built dwellings, when you cut trees. All of their norms were really based around the health of the land base, because they recognized that nothing is possible unless the land base is healthy. Everything else is irrelevant. You know, everything else becomes irrelevant. And so from there, I want to go on to one of the things that I think has destroyed our ability to collectively organize is horizontal hostility. Now, horizontal hostility was a term that was coined by feminists in the 1970s, which described the infighting or the factionalism in the women's movement. But I think that, you know, we're experiencing that on the left side of politics. Just, it's rampant. And it's destroying our ability to organize collectively and build coalitions. And I want to say, we don't have to agree on everything. We don't have to have exactly the same ideologies. And I was talking about this with my friend Gabe, who's sitting right here, about a month ago, tip of the hat, thank you, and saying that, you know, life on Earth is being systematically killed by the powerful for profit. And if it doesn't matter to me, if somebody understands that, I'm willing to work with them. They don't have to agree with me about everything. And I don't have to agree with them. I'm a mature enough adult to be able to do that. And I think that it's time that we put our differences aside and find the things that we agree on and work towards creating powerful allyships and communities that are working in coalition to face down power. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's so important, because if we don't do that, if we don't reach that understanding, we were talking last night and Togastai said, we don't have 2 years. We don't have 5 years. We have to start doing this now. And so for those of you who want to take this conversation further and want to think about how we strategize and go further, we invite you after this panel. We don't want to take away from the headliners, but this is our chance. If people want to have a further conversation about this, some of us will be in the lobby after this panel to talk about where we go, what are the next steps to take. So I invite you to join us if that is something of interest to you. And I'm just going to wind up here now, because I've seen the 1 minute sign from the front, and I'm going to hand this to Togastai. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Sabah. Togastai.
Denise at you. Taka's at you. Sky's at you. I'd like to, first of all, acknowledge the Ohlone people and them allowing us to present here today. The ancestors that have lived here and thrived here, their spirits are still with us, and I'm sure they're proud about the work that's being done this weekend. I spend a lot of time thinking about climate change, because that's something that we're facing, not just on a global scale, but at our own community and regional scales. I grew up in Wet'suwet'en territory with my grandparents, as I was introduced. They taught me a lot about hunting, fishing, and trapping, and the seasonal rounds that we have to take. And through my lifetime, I'm in my mid-40s now, through my lifetime, I've witnessed dramatic change. There's places where I can't do things anymore. The seasonal rounds that we followed in the past have changed. We can't do certain things certain times of the year anymore. Sometimes things happen 2 or 3 weeks before we expected it to happen, and we end up scrambling around to try and see if we can seize that opportunity to go and harvest food for ourselves to put away for the winter. life is becoming more and more difficult for us as traditionalists, people who want to live off of the land and do as much as we can to connect ourselves to this beautiful mother that supports us. It's becoming more and more difficult for us to achieve the simplest things of survival, the simplest things of knowing our relationship with the mother and all of the other creatures that we share this space with. There's so much happening with climate change that life is changing around us. I talked with some guys this morning, or last night, there was an interview that was going on, and they asked me a question about what I thought about climate change in the future and the system. And I said, the system depends on us. And the system is designed to separate us from nature. But we depend on nature. And we need to hold up that responsibility to nature. As human beings, we're failing that responsibility today. Like I said to Saba this morning, we don't have the luxury of time in our hands. Time is not on our side now. It may have been on our side 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago, but time is not on our side anymore. I listened to some of the presenters this morning, and one of the things that is kind of stuck out was the Arctic ice shelf. It's melting. There's cruise ships being planned to go through there. The tar sands and the fracking fields are both dumping their wastes into the Arctic ice shelf. They're dumping it into the Arctic ice shelf, and the Arctic ice shelf is melting. If you're not sure about the impacts of petroleum waste, have a look at what industry is doing. The fracking waste that comes out of Pennsylvania is being used as an ice melt in New York. They put them in tankers and they spread it out on the highways so that the highways will be safer for people to drive on. It's their way of dealing with a lot of their fracking waste. We have an urgency that we should be answering to. This planet is under the greatest duress it's ever been because of the complacency of the human population. In large part, the human population is sitting by and watching it all happen, spectators of this giant, massive play being played out. And we don't realize we're a part of that. We're living creatures that depend on that. But we're sitting back and hoping somebody else is going to step up and be that change. There's indigenous people from all over Turtle Island who are fighting the system today. I wrote a list of some of them. We have the Gitxan, who are our neighbors. They've been our neighbors for thousands of years. They started a camp this year called Mati Lee Camp, and they're stopping TransCanada from coming through their territories and all other pipelines. We have the Nisga grassroots movement. The Nisga people are in northern BC. They just signed an agreement with TransCanada to allow a pipeline through lava beds that are their sacred grounds. And the Nisga grassroots people stood up and said, I have not been consulted. And they're standing up and they're going to defend their traditional lands from the exploitation that is being proposed on it by multinational companies. We have the Secwepemc people. Mount Polly, one of the most recent ones. This giant spill, this tailings pond, burst and let all these, this effluent of heavy metals into salmon-bearing rivers and are still contaminated at this second. They had no intention of ever cleaning it up fully. They still have no intention of doing that. They walked away from that problem. And they're continuing on with business as usual. The Tahltan people from the north have the Red Chris mine to deal with. That same company that was responsible for the Mount Polly spill is responsible for the Red Chris mine. A third party, they hired a third party consultation firm to come in and have a look at the tailings design, the tailings pond design of the Red Chris mine project. And they said there are so many problems with that that they're going to run out of paper writing all these issues that they're seeing with it. but the BC government, the British Columbia government, the Canadian government are still in full support of this company that led out one of the largest tailings pond disasters in Canadian history. We also have the Tsleil-Waututh people fighting the Kinder Morgan pipeline. You guys might have seen in the news recently, there's people being arrested. There's people who are fighting on the front lines of stopping this pipeline expansion company from coming in and increasing the capacity of the tar sands. We have the Cree trappers in northern Saskatchewan who are blockading petroleum companies from doing any work in their territories. We have the Mi'kmaq people who are fighting SWN, an American company, from coming in and doing fracking in their territories. We have Algonquin people who we've created alliances with very recently as well, who are fighting logging. The Tahltan I mentioned, the Anishinaabeg are fighting Line 9, and of course the Six Nations fighting Energy East. This is a small handful of these groups. We have the Oglala as well. We met with the Oglala quite a few times, the Lakota, who are fighting the XL pipeline. We have responsibilities that we have to live up to, and I want to kind of share a story about some of those responsibilities. It's a story that my daughter shared with me. She had a chance to work with a Tletletene elder up in the north central part of our province, and she said that he shared a story with her. He said, in ancient times, our people were fishermen. Our people were fishermen, and we depended on the salmon that came up. But one year, the salmon didn't return. They waited, and they waited, and they waited, and they waited. The salmon failed to return. Towards the end of the natural fishing season, the salmon did return, but in really small numbers. So they decided, collectively as a community, as a nation, that they were not going to fish for salmon that year so that they would ensure that there would be salmon for future generations. In the following winter, more than half the people died. They sacrificed themselves for the future generations. That's something that they were willing to do. And that story guides me today. It provides that light in this darkness that exists, that envelops in this system called civilization. It guides me and is providing a place for me to go. As a hereditary chief, as a traditionalist, I have no choice but to stop these frickin' pipelines from coming onto our territories. In order to win this fight, we're going to have to we're going to have to hunker down. We're going to have to get our knuckles bloody. But we're not going to do it alone. If we intend on making sure that this planet is going to be safe for future generations, we have to make sure that it's not just a fringe culture that is standing up and defending it. We have to make sure and absolutely sure that it's a popular culture that's going to stand up. We have to inject ourselves into popular culture today to get that message out there, because if the message doesn't get out there, our futures are doomed. And I'm an optimist at heart. Despite everything that our people have been through, despite the struggles, despite the climate crisis that we're living in today, I have to remain an optimist because I have children and I want grandchildren. But in order for us to remain optimistic, we have to escape from fringe culture and move into popular culture and get our message out there. Do everything we can. We need to change our strategy, because if we don't, each and every one of us are going to be doomed. And we're each and every one of us are going to be responsible for that. Oh, what's up?
Thank you, Togastai. Sock Edge.
going to speak up here because I'm used to standing. Spent 21 years teaching warrior societies, instructing. And I usually do it from a standing position, so I feel much more comfortable this way. And I want to begin, much like my brother did, by acknowledging the land we're upon and that of the Ohlone people. This is a custom of acknowledging because it reminds us of where we're grounded to. It reminds us of the land and of the importance. And I'm really happy to be able to begin any kind of teachings or talks in that way. Puts our mind in the right place. What I want to do is kind of real quick talk a little bit about warrior societies as this community of resistance. I'm talking about indigenous warrior societies. And to give you an example of what it's about, what it's like, so we can understand what does a community of resistance really look like. Not one that's just been around for a little while, not one that has just kind of been a single issue kind of organization, but one that's been around since time immemorial. So we'll talk about that as a format. Now, in particular, those of you who've been around organizing, in particular, trying to get some type of organization built right from the very beginning, you might be a little bit accustomed to what I'm going to use for a moment, because I want to use it as a way of creating common language. Now, I'm sure you've heard that if you want to build an organization, you're going to start somewhere with a shared worldview, right? So we don't sit there and conflict all the time and argue over every little thing. The next thing you want to do is be able to have a strategic vision. You want to have an idea. What does this organization look like? What is it doing? What is it about? What is this kind of end state that this organization will achieve? From that strategic vision, you want to create strategic goals. Those strategic goals are just nothing more than objectives that are derived from that strategic vision. From there, we start to talk about what does a mission statement look like, and finally, a strategic plan. Now, that's a very formal way of looking at how to build an organization. But it might be a familiar way, because if you pick up a lot of text and you do a lot of reading, we're kind of always presented with these kind of step-by-steps. How do we do that? So I decided I'll use that as a common way of discussing warrior societies. So look at the common worldview, the first step. Warrior societies obviously have a common worldview. Can you hear me well enough without the speaker?
Yeah.
I prefer to speak without that, all right?
No. Use the mic.
How's this? No?
Use the mic.
All right. Without the mic, huh? That's definitely my preference.
There you go.
Okay, much better. It feels way too static and lacks energy, right? Behind this really stuffy formal podium. So let me begin. All right, a worldview, a place where we could look back and find our legacies, our histories, our understanding of how we interpret the world. For indigenous people and warrior societies, this is easy. It comes from our culture. But what's important, I'm going to draw from that so you can understand this, is the idea of natural order. The world exists in its own natural order. It has its way of going about to ensure life will continue. Life will be there to reproduce itself. It doesn't need us. It doesn't need us to do that. There's an existing natural order that, if it was left alone, would ensure there would be an abundance of life around us. Now, as humans, we need to observe the mechanisms that ensure that natural order is in place. For indigenous people, we call that natural law. What mechanisms do we need to ensure that we don't interfere and cause problems with this natural order, the balance and harmony that ensures that all life will continue in a very flourishing way? Those are natural laws. And finally, we have a concept of natural justice, and that's the upholding of the natural laws. Those who deliberately choose to violate natural law have to be dealt with in some way. Now, luckily for most indigenous people, it's simply a teaching, and it gets our mind back in the right place. But rarely, and once in a great while, there's an actual enforcement action. That is the role of warriors. They uphold natural justice. Now, as a slight aside to this, my people, the Mi'kmaq, we have the word smogness for warrior. We have a very important principle. We are forbidden to forgive. We are forbidden to forgive. Because if your responsibility is natural justice and upholding it, you do not turn a blind eye to injustice. You do not create excuses You cannot forgive. You have to help maintain that balance of justice. All right. That becomes our common worldview. Our idea of a strategic vision comes from our sacred responsibilities. Now this, you could talk to any indigenous nation and they all have their own interpretation of this. Sometimes we call this the original instructions. Sometimes we call it the sacred instructions. But real briefly, what it means is that we are here to protect our homelands, our version, our piece of Mother Earth. We're here to protect all life in those homelands. That's our responsibility. And not only do we protect it for the next seven generations. That means I have to ensure the homeland that I will hand over to the next seven generations has to be as good, if not better, than the way I received it. And that becomes part of our responsibility. That is at the core of what warrior societies do and think. We have a responsibility to protect our homelands. This is not a hobby. This is not a career. This is not a choice. It is a sacred obligation. This is the very foundation of how warrior societies start to organize and understand what their job is. When we talk about strategic goals, we do come right back to that sacred responsibility. And we say our goals are about protection of that homeland. And we ask ourselves, what kind of actions, what kind of operations, what kind of things need to take place to do that protection? And we can start to pick out our strategic goals, our strategic objectives, based on that. From there, if you've done the formal method of building an organization, you'd say, all right, I have a strategic vision, I have strategic goals, now it's time to make a mission statement. For us, our mission statement dictates the concept of doctrine. Now, I've heard people talk about the ideas of civil disobedience, nonviolence. That's a doctrine when it comes down to resistance. For warrior societies, our doctrine is a wide spectrum. We encourage the use of every possible tactic you can in a peaceful manner. But you do not write off the concept of self-defense because we have a sacred responsibility to protect that land one way or another. So this becomes the foundation of how we think, of how we operate. And for us, we can truly say this is something that wasn't just created in the last couple of decades. It isn't something that we just turn around and just thought up on our own. This has been a responsibility handed down from one generation to the next, to the next. Now, the Yaqti have a great way of describing their warriors, the Yoemi. They're called the protectors of the Hayakim. That's the name for their homeland. The Hayakim. So it's a very direct way of understanding exactly what is their vision, their strategic vision. What is their strategic goals, or what are they? And what are their responsibilities? So when warrior societies say we are engaged in the protection of our homeland, we are engaged in the protection of nature, we are really saying we are exercising and living up to that sacred responsibility our ancestors have passed on to us, and we will pass on to the next seven generations. So, speaking from a legacy of a 500-year-old war, speaking from that history of fighting colonialism, fighting the destruction of our homeland, for those of you that will commit yourself to this kind of fight, I tell you, welcome to the war.
Thank you very much. And Frida.
First of all, I want to thank the Ohlone people whose territory I'm standing on, and it's part of our culture to always ensure that we're welcome onto another nation's territory before we come on, so I would like to thank the lady that gave the welcome this morning. So I'm Frida Hewson, and I come from the Hunasdaten people, and Hunasdaten is people of the headwaters, and my people have protected our headwaters for time immemorial, and we have a hereditary system that has been in place for thousands and thousands of years, and our people were forced off our land probably about 100 years ago, where the government set up reservations and divided all our people into five different bands and forced us onto small tracts of lands to keep us off our lands. So in doing so, they were able to exploit all the resources off our lands, and probably 10 years ago or so, the people of my generation, because we've got brought up culturally by my parents, aunties, grandparents, always took us out to the land to harvest berries, hunt fish, and every time we went back to our territories, we just noticed more and more of our territory was decimated, and every time we'd sit around, we felt like we didn't have a voice, that we were silenced. The residential school silenced our people so that we couldn't speak up for ourselves, and taught our elders that we couldn't speak out. And when we first started coming to our elders saying that we needed to do something, I said, if we don't do anything, there will be nothing left for our future generation. We don't want to be telling our children the stories that we used to have salmon. We used to hunt moose on this territory. So our generation spoke to our chiefs and said that we need to do something. Look around. There's only like 10% of our land that is usable anymore because everything is destroyed. It has been overlogged. They have mining, and now pipelines are threatening the last remaining 10% of our territory that we have left. If we permit those pipelines through, the future generations will have nothing. And we started Unistaten Camp probably about 5 years ago because the pipelines were being proposed probably 7 years ago. And even though our hereditary chiefs had said no, a definite no to these projects, industry and government was still trying to skirt around our hereditary chiefs and still go ahead with their projects. So because of the crookedness of industry that they still try to come in, even though we said no when we're burying my brother, they knew, I'm pretty sure they had inside people telling them we're busy with the funeral, so they called the drill company and gave them 5 telephone calls and said, you need to go in now, you need to go in now. And they were saying racist comments about us indigenous people, and one of the employees of the drill company didn't like what they were saying, so they called one of our hereditary chiefs, and we were still sitting at my brother's wake the night before the funeral, and he came down and spoke to my chief and said that if you're going to stop the pipelines, they're planning to go in 5 o'clock in the morning. So after that meeting, Tagastai came down to the wake, and after the two chiefs had met, he sat down with them and said at their word he would go up to the territory and just miss the funeral. So that's what ended up happening. Tagastai, one of my uncles and my cousin decided to go up, and by midnight, the night of the wake, they drove up the 2-hour trip to the territory, and sure enough, 5 o'clock in the morning, the drill company was trying to come into our territory. And it's these dishonest tactics that forced us to put up a full-on blockade 3 years ago, and 5 years ago we built a cabin right in route of the original Enbridge and Pacific Trails pipeline route. And 2 years after that construction of the cabin, they moved their route 1 kilometer and 3 kilometer upstream from where we put our cabin. So we put a pit house in the other route where Pacific Trails is planning their route, and we are now planning another cabin probably 3 kilometers up and a healing lodge. Because to me, residential schools did their job to take the Indian out of our children, and we want to create a healing lodge. We'll put the Indian back in our children. Because our belief is Tagastai and what we're doing is because we still have the Indian in us, because our parents and grandparents made sure of that. And my grandma lived to be 113 years old, and she was the one that she outlived all her children. So she taught the grandchildren where all their territory was and taught them how to live off the land. And they, in turn, our parents, taught us how to stay connected to the land. And because we were connected to the land, we're going to stand up for the land. And everybody else that's not standing up for the land have a disconnect. And I must honestly say, probably about 7 years ago, I almost got disconnected because I went to the public school system that said I had to get an education, I had to get a job, I had to buy a house, I have to buy a car. So that is the kind of lifestyle I led probably for 14 years. I had a full-time employment where I paid off my house, paid off 5 cars, kept trading in my vehicles for brand new vehicles, till I came to the realization that I needed to change my way of thinking. And that's how I had to decolonize my mind in order for me to change what I was doing and how I was doing it. And I've made the decision that I will not buy a brand new vehicle again. And right now I just buy everything, use, recycle, or anything I buy, I try to hang on to it for 10, 20 years and make sure it lasts, because I don't want it to go into the landfill, or else figure out a way how to fix it so that it's still usable. If people change their way of thinking, that's the only way we're going to see change. We have to make change with ourselves before we can make change for the world. And it starts with yourself. So we've been running an action camp. This last August was probably our 5th action camp. And 5 years ago, we started that because even though we're traditionalists and people always ask me when I became an activist, I said I never became an activist. I was born into protecting everything around me because we're connected to it. We were taught to take only what you need, give back, and always ensure that the land is going to sustain you. Your generation, 7 generations down the road, that your children, your grandchildren are all going to have use of the land. And where we have our camp, we actually have a river that flows by it that you actually still can take a cup into the river and drink it. It's that clean. And that's where they're proposing to put the pipelines underneath these rivers. And that's where our salmon spawn. And during the action camp, we have about 200 or so people that come from all over the world. And we come together and we have different workshops like decolonization workshops and how to get your messaging across so that you get out via media what you really want, the important things you want to get out. And we also started running spring camps, which we had the 2nd annual spring camp this last spring. We have it in May, where we run a 3-week camp where volunteers from all over come in and help us. They helped us the first year with the permaculture garden, which we also put in the way of Pacific Trails Pipeline, and also put in a pit house in the first spring camp. And then the 2nd spring camp, we put in a bunkhouse, which a bunch of people from the Lower Mainland in Vancouver fundraised. I think it was $30,000, and a bunch of volunteers put up a bunkhouse within 3 weeks, just so that there would be space for people to sleep when they come to volunteer. And like I said, we're talking about putting in a healing center, because my niece is going to be finishing her doctorate in psychology, and she wants to help our young people, because right now our young people are lost. They have a lot of indigenous community. You see high rates of suicide. It's because our young people are disconnected from our lands. They're disconnected from our culture, because they're told they have to dismiss who they are and become like Europeans. And when they're telling us we have to dismiss who we are, they're spiritually dead. And that's why there's so much suicide. Because if you're spiritually dead, then you don't feel like you belong. And I am so thankful that my parents and my grandparents did their duty to instill my culture into me so that I could stand firm and stand strong, and I'm not going to waver from to no bad industry will come on our lands ever.
Thank you very much, Frida, and thank all of you for four amazing presentations. I want to start with having you just talk about, I'll just throw it out to all four of you. We talked about this briefly before the presentation here. how you demonstrate your beliefs by how you live as opposed to talking about them. Whoever wants to take that up.
Well, for myself, for the last 2 years, we've been living at the blockade in the cabin. We winter there, we trap, we put away salmon, meat. So we're actually living our culture. We're not just talking about it, we're living. And we're not just talking about actions, we're doing them. For the last 5 years, my clan kicked out a mining company and another one of our territory where they were doing exploration, and was the same thing. We gave them till Friday, 12 noon, remove all your stuff off our territory, you're trespassing. So we're living it. We're not just talking about it. We're living and kicking people off our lands, because that's basically what we have to do, because for 13 years our people sat at a treaty table trying to negotiate treaty, and in the end, they're trying to give us the short end of the stick, and there's not going to be no treaty, and we decided that they've mismanaged our lands for hundreds of years. Our people need to start managing our lands.
When it comes down to the idea of warrior and what does it mean to live that, that's actually one of the biggest distinctions we try to make. It's the idea that being an indigenous warrior is a way of life. And it's not simply just showing up at actions when they kind of come up and you just happen to show up and do something over there. It's about understanding that's a way of life. This is a daily practice. So in the warrior society, we have something we call warrior arts and warriorhood. Warrior arts are based around the idea of the art of protecting your homeland. So it's a collection of skill sets you need to be in a warrior society if you can be effective at protecting your homeland. Warriorhood is the daily practice of those skill sets. In our warrior society, when we train, we have 300 skill sets we teach within the society. And that's everything from self-defense all the way up to strategy development. And we have to practice that as a way of life, much like somebody in martial arts will commit themselves to a daily practice of developing themselves and improving upon themselves. We have a very similar philosophy. So for us, when we talk about warrior societies in a daily practice, or living it daily, it is about that warriorhood and daily practice. We want to be good at what we're doing for the sake of protecting that land.
When people come out to the camp and spend time with us, we get a lot of volunteers from all over the planet that come out and join us. When they come out, one of the first things I emphasize with them is you're not going to come out here and expect that you're going to get into violent confrontation right off the bat. The first thing we're going to teach you is to love, fall in love with the earth again. Fall in love with the relationship and the responsibility that you have with that earth. Because once you fall in love with something, you're going to defend it to your death. Fighting for something you don't really understand doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we spend a lot of time teaching people who come out to the camp about building a relationship with the world around us. We teach them ceremonies, where ceremonies are necessary. We teach them respect. We teach them to not be tourists on the landscape. We teach them to understand that just because you live in a city apart from most of the natural world doesn't mean that you're going to walk into a place and be a tourist and start taking pictures and say, I was a part of the natural world for a short period of my life. And this is some examples of that. This is proof that I was a part of a natural world at one time, at one point. We teach people to decolonize their brains and their spirits and their bodies enough to say that that is wrong. There's something inherently wrong with the idea that we go out and we be tourists on a landscape that we depend on all as human beings. The system was designed to separate us from the natural world. And it's in our genetics as human beings to be part of that natural world. But the system is designed to separate us from that. You look at the education systems. They teach you all about capitalism. They teach you all about being a good citizen. But they never really teach you about the responsibilities you have with the natural world around you anymore. That was integral to all human beings around this planet at one point. So decolonize yourselves. Become a part of the earth again. Start to learn about that. Embrace it. Challenge yourself. Get it there and start making change. Don't sit back and wait and hope that one of us are going to do it for you or going to lead the way. Get out there and be the change.
Okay, so, I mean, in my personal life, my activism is extremely important to me, and that's why most of my adult life has been spent in organizing and fighting for the things that I love and wish to defend. And teaching my children, of which I have two, a girl and a boy, 10 and 11, and they were here earlier, I don't know if they're still here, but to make them, as Togastai just said, fall in love with the world and all of, you know, the trees and the soil and the plants and the fungi and the insects and the bugs, and teach them that every living being has spirit. That's including the rocks and the mountains and the rivers, and all of them deserve respect.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions from the crowd, but before I get to those and any others, I wanted to have y'all address the fact that, you know, what's so common in mainstream dominant culture is that state violence, right now, police violence is so clear. It's just rampant, out of control, but it's never referred to as violence. It's referred to as security and that kind of thing. But if resistance communities talk about, as a last resort, possibly engaging in violence, it's referred to as violence. So that's obviously a challenge that you're up against. I mean, how do you address that?
We may end up in a situation in our homelands where we are forced to defend our lands. And that's something that we're not going to shy away from. But it's not something that we're going to encourage. Like Saba said at the beginning, my good friend Mel Basil said that warriors expend all efforts in finding a peaceful solution. And that's what we're doing. This is an example of that. Us coming out and sharing our story with people about our struggle, creating awareness, looking for people to help instill change in the system is a part of that. But if we ever had to resort to violence, you're guaranteed that we will fight for all that we love. And we will fight harder and better than anybody else who doesn't have that as a guiding principle in a battle. That battlefield that we're going to be in, we're going to have the advantage. Even if we have less numbers, we're going to have the advantage because we have love in our hearts, we have our ancestors on our side, and we know what we're doing and why we're doing it. So, you know, I know the civilized, you know, this civilization that captured all of us and keeps us captive has its messages and its propaganda. And not everybody has to listen to that. We can all wake the hell up and start doing something different and seeing the world in a different way and realize that each and every one of us have responsibilities. It's not just the indigenous land defenders, but all those who support them. So if it does resort to violence one day, then so be it. It's not unlike what the RCMP are doing in Burnaby 2 days ago, when they grabbed a 72-year-old elder and threw her to the ground, violently to the ground, a good friend of ours who was at our camp about 3 weeks ago. She teaches carpentry at a college. She came and helped build the bunkhouse that Frida talked about, and she just helped us put up a root cellar. And, you know, we watched in shock and anger and rage as the RCMP grabbed her from behind and threw her to the ground as hard as they could. You know, that really pissed me off. And rightfully so. Why the hell do we condone those types of things? Why do we minimize the actions from the state when they do violent stuff like that and call it security? If we were going to do that, fuck security, state. And to hell with the system.
Sakaj, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I think on that note, we have to understand, how do you manage an empire, right? And one of the most important things with an empire is ensuring that you have a monopoly on violence, that you are the only one that can legitimately enforce violence. Anybody else that goes out and commits an act of self-defense somehow usually is considered a murderer. When a state does it, it's all in some kind of pursuit of higher ideals and the rule of law. But when you're bombing children, that's still an act of murder. There's no difference. Right. What we have to be able to remember is the state should not dictate to us whether or not we have an inherent right to defend ourselves and defend the land. We should not give up on that fight. We should reject the idea that the nation state could take that away from us. We all should be able to say, I can defend myself. I shouldn't have to be able to put my hands down just because the morality of the state dictates that I can't defend myself. So it's important that we reject imperialist notions of this monopoly on violence.
Thank you. Go ahead, Sabah.
And I think we should come up with a different word than violence, because violence comes in lots of different forms. There's gratuitous violence that the state engages in, and then there's the protective use of force, which is defensive. It's not gratuitous. It doesn't go out, as in the way of the warrior, it does not go out to start to be violent in the first place. It tries to start from peaceful methods. But when you love someone and love something and they are systematically being killed in front of you, then to sit back and do nothing is to concur in the violence that is being done. I think we have to stand up and defend. Defense is very different from violence, very different.
I just wanted to say is we as a people that need to help change what has been put out there for... I like the example, a friend of mine said she went into a school system and shared two pictures with children, an indigenous person that had fatigues on. They said that was a bad person. And then she put a military person's picture up. Oh, they're there to serve and protect. So what's the difference when the indigenous person is trying to serve and protect their lands for their people, and supposedly the person in a military fatigue is protecting the nation? So that's just what media puts out there, that they're labeling us as terrorists for protecting our homelands. And yet it's okay for the military to go to another country and shoot children and women.
Thank you. We've got about 3 minutes left. I had a couple of questions from the audience. I'm going to read a couple of them, and you can do what you want with them. But I do want everybody to have at least a short time to have some closing remarks. First question, are there hierarchies in communities that are healthy, or is hierarchy always oppressive? The next one, what is the difference between a culture of resistance and merely dropping out or withdrawing from the mainstream? So those are the questions. Address them if you like. And why don't we start with Sabah and come this way, and each of you take about a minute and a half.
Well, I'll take the one about cultures of resistance and withdrawal. Well, withdrawal, it seems to me, is much more of an individualistic thing. It's when somebody decides that they don't want to partake in the capitalist economy, they're going to go and set up somewhere and try and live as sustainably, in inverted commas, as possible. And I think that we see a lot of that in nowadays in what passes for activist circles, and the difference of that individual action and then organizing collectively is that there's much more power in being in a group. And that's, and I come back to what Kathleen Dean Moore said, which is, don't be one person. And a culture of resistance is a culture that is telling people, as Frieda and Tobestai and Saka just said, that you don't have to follow the dominant culture's definitions of things. We can do things differently, but that's going to mean that we have to do them together. And it's high time we did that.
The questions were, what's the difference between a culture of resistance and merely dropping out or withdrawing from the mainstream? And the others are there hierarchies in communities that are healthy, or is hierarchy always oppressive?
I can do the culture of resistance one, I guess. I think anybody who fosters an avenue of critical thinking lives in a world of resistance. And it's something that I've always encouraged. I used to teach environmental monitoring for colleges in northern Alberta and northern BC. And the Northern Lakes Community College in Alberta hired me to go up to Fort Chipewyan in 2006 to teach environmental monitoring to 12 students that were there. They hired me, I went up there, I started teaching the course, and I realized that it was Shell Canada that gave the college money for me to teach this course on environmental monitoring. So these Aboriginal people in the village would go and begin work for Shell Canada to do environmental monitoring for them on the tar sands expansion projects. And I spent some time with the students at that 3 months I was there teaching them to be critical thinkers. I taught them the basics of environmental monitoring, but I started teaching them a lot more about critical thinking. And I said, you're going to be able to stand up on your own 2 feet and start making decisions as Athabascan and Chipewyan people. And it's going to be your responsibility to do that. During that time period, the students, I had to give them breaks out of the college course to attend funerals. There were 3 people that died in that 3 months. Each of them died from rare forms of cancer that came from the tar sands. Elders came in and shared like heartbreaking stories about their experiences and their families dying off. Students were enraged about having their grandmother tell them that they moved to another territory to raise their children. And that place changed my life. I told them, this place changed my life. I'm going to leave here, and it's going to fuel me to do everything that I can to stop the tar sands from continuing to expand, and it's going to change the way that I think. And that's what happened. I kind of got thrown into this world of resistance in a really harsh way when I experienced that. And that was the beginning of the biggest part of my life around this struggle. And it was, like Frieda mentioned, it was our teachings, the way that we were raised, that kind of guided me in that journey.
I guess hierarchy would be the controversial question, so I'll tackle that one, all right? And I'm sure I'll get a lot of dissenters. However, I'll speak from historical perspective of warrior societies on this. Consensus, it's king. Consensus rules, right? If you study indigenous politics, consensus, 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 right? Well, that's great for political, social, economic decision-making. Resistance, on-the-ground action, hierarchical. Now, I'm also saying this from a historical perspective. Geronimo, Crazy Horse, Pontiac, and Tecumseh all advocated a chain of command and a hierarchical approach to what they were doing in the defense of society that exercises political, social, economic consensus. It's a different realm. It requires a different form of thought and a different form of decision-making. One that uses a lot more exercise of leadership than what we're used to seeing today when we think of hierarchies, because it's more about persuasion than coercion within a hierarchical structure. It's very different. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but really the leadership aspect of this kind of resistance using hierarchies is different. But it is important to have a hierarchical structure within an action-based kind of organization.
Where are the women?
There's plenty within a warrior society. There's plenty within a warrior society. No, I agree. I agree entirely. I agree with you. But within warrior societies, particularly in the last 3 decades, we've seen a huge amount of women coming into warrior societies. They've taken up that role. They're filling in where a lot of men are now neglecting their responsibility to protect the land, and the women are starting to fill in those roles. So I don't know if that serves as a possible potential model for future resistance, but you can look to the Agitida, which are the warrior societies around the prairies in Canada, and they have the highest contingent of women warriors within their group called the Agitida Kwe.
For myself, I just wanted to bring it back to, because with a colonizer state, we all fall patriarchy. And to me, I believe the patriarchy is the main problem with what's happening with the world. And through my culture, we're matrilineal. So it's the matriarchs who the men get their direction from. So whenever there was going to be war, the matriarchs said, yes, we go to war. No, we don't go to war. So it's the matriarchs that makes decisions. And to me, women think with their heart. So the Mother Earth is in trouble because we have patriarchy leading and they think with their head. And they're so disconnected, and that's why we're in trouble. So we need to get back to the indigenous people who think and make decisions through their matriarchs. The world needs to get lessons from the indigenous people.
And on that note, thank all of you so very much. I only wish we had more time. Onward to the next group.